Hello and welcome to the Physical Preparation Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Robertson, and this is the MR Radio Show. Now, hope you guys don't mind me doing two of these in a row. Last week was like a 40 for 40 type deal. Had a lot of fun with that. I've gotten amazing feedback. So if you wrote me, you know, hit me up on IG, Twitter, Facebook, wherever. Appreciate the support. Thank you so much for that. But this week, I wanted to go in just a little bit different direction because just the way the schedule has worked the last couple of weeks and coordinating schedules with other coaches, trainers, it's been hard to get people on these last couple of weeks. So this show, instead of just being all of my philosophical thoughts on life and training and all that, is going to be peer-led. So we got a massive Q&A show lined up for you this week. I'm super excited about it. Before we get into it, kind of the weekly recap, if you will. Number one, the kids' soccer season is slowly wrapping up. We have two more weeks of games, but last week was awesome. I mean, so much fun because it's really cool to watch both the boys and the girls kind of evolve and get better. Our girls are still killing it. They look great. Kendall has seriously gotten better like every single week to the point now where, I mean, in the last game or two games ago, she got her first goal of the season. Of course, I wasn't there, right? The weekend that I'm in Seattle, she bangs her first goal of the year. But then last week, I felt like, man, she's playing really well. She got two goals last week. So just so awesome for her. And I always try and explain to them, like, look, you can do so many good things in soccer without scoring goals. But at the same time, let's be honest, little kids love the fact that if you score a goal, it feels amazing. So super excited for her. And then not to be upstaged, we sprint over and we go to Cade's game. And that dude banged five goals in one game. So they are both just getting better each and every week. We went out actually on Sunday. I had a Dick's Sporting Goods card. We bought him a little goal. It's made out of like PVC pipes and that sort of thing. So we got that in the backyard. So they're loving that. So everything is good there. It's been really rewarding. And again, I just learned so much coaching these little people, and not just my little people, but other people's little people. So it's been really fun. I've learned a ton about myself as a coach. Also, you know, I thought I was going to get kind of a little bit of chill downtime before the soccer off season started, but got a new football player in, defensive tackle. So I've been working with him a little bit this last week. It's definitely interesting because, you know, for me, soccer and basketball are like kind of my two things, and you know, baseball, football, a lot of these I'll kind of pass off, but this guy was a referral from a high-level athlete of mine, so didn't want to pass it up, and it's been really fun. I'm excited to see where this guy's at. A little bit raw athletically, just because he hasn't trained a ton since he finished up with college, but, you know, if all goes well, I'm really excited about his potential. So be on the lookout for more information on my guy here. I'm excited to see where he's at. And then last but not least, this was really fun. This past week, I got to go down and hang out at IU basically for the day. And this is a plan I made like 2 months ago, right? Because one of my former athletes, Danny O'Rourke, literally the first pro soccer player I ever worked with, has since retired from the MLS, 11-year career, and took a job as the assistant soccer coach at IU. So I was like, dude, I got to come down there. I want to see your guys' operation. Also, I've tried to catch like two other games and they've been rained out. So I'm like, man, I'm going to come down. I'm going to see you. I'm just going to make a day out of it. So drop Kate off at school, cruise down. And it was fun. I also got to chat with my boy Lance Goyke for about an hour on the drive down there since he's out in San Fran now. But get down there and get to hang out with the soccer coaches for a while. Me and Dio, we go and have coffee, which is always fantastic because that guy doesn't drink. It's not Folgers crystals. Like, we always drink good coffee and have good conversation. Got to go over and see Cliff Marshall, who's the IU men's basketball strength coach. So we got to hang out with him and chat a little bit. And then, would you believe it? But we get a text when we're sitting there with Cliff. It's 1:30 in the afternoon, and he gets a text that says, sorry, due to unplayable field conditions, the game tonight is canceled. I was like, come on, man. Come on. So now literally three times, I'm pretty sure the men's soccer team is going to ban me. Like, they will not let me at a game, even if they're going to play it, because there's a potential that it could get canceled. So regardless, you know, I was kind of bummed about that, but I still got to hang out, got to watch a film session, got to watch a practice session, which is always good. Just watching, you know, what other coaches do, how they interact, how they run sessions, how they run drills. And it was just a really good day, not only to see, you know, what they're doing as a staff, but to see things kind of come full circle, right? Because Danny was obviously a very high level player. You don't play 1 year, let alone 11 in the MLS without being a great player. But now to see him come full circle and now be a coach and watch him interact with people was just super rewarding for me. So very excited about him. Very excited about, again, just kind of widening the network, always getting to know more coaches, different sports, learning more about what we do, right? Because just because I'm not talking to another personal trainer or another strength and conditioning coach doesn't mean I can't learn a ton about coaching from coaches from different segments and different areas of the sports world. So all in all, really good week, got a ton done and just excited about where things are at. So enough from me. I'm going to stop rambling. Let's go ahead and let's jump into this week's show. And this first question is going to come from my boy, Saul. All right, guys. So our first question comes from Saul Jimenez, and Saul has a very specific question. So he says, if you were going to program a 4-week cycle, 3 days per week of training with just 6 movements or exercises for R3 through R6, what would the exercises be and why? If you need more exercises, what are they and why? The athlete is Jin Pa, 40 years old, not competitive with no specific goal other than long-term health. They're new to coaching, athletic, but low training age. You can choose if they're a male or female, no major orthopedic issues other than desk jockey issues, tight T spine, hips, lack of core, etc. So I wasn't really clear as to if I had 6 exercises total or 6 exercises per area. So I'm just going to kind of focus on the big things that I would do for this person. So R4, R5, and R6 are, you know, the main pieces of the training session. So that's what I'll focus on. You guys know me, you know, everybody is an athlete. So in R4, they're going to do something that is working on power, explosiveness, but that also isn't too, the possibility of injury is going to be low. So if they're qualified to do something like a low level box jump, by all means, I'm going to go there. If not, maybe I'm just going to prep them a little bit more and go with something real low level reactive like a jump rope, because chances are if they're athletic, they've jump roped in the past, and most people are shocked at how poor they are at jump roping and how poor their conditioning is. So I may start off with something like that on one day. On a second day, it may be some form of a med ball throw. It could be half kneeling. It could be tall kneeling. It could be a lateral put. It could be a med ball slam. Honestly, you can go in any direction you want, but I just love to do something powerful and explosive to start a session off. So those, I mean, I don't even need 6. There's 2. And I would probably just lead each session with that. As far as R5 goes, these are the main variations or progressions that I would hit. I'd hit a squat, a hinge, a lunge or split squat variation, depending on what they can do, a push-up, some form of either a rower chin, most likely, and then some form of core exercise. Now, you want to know the whys behind this. Squat, to me, is arguably the most fundamental movement pattern. I mean, you think back to the Stone Ages, without being, you know, disgusting, I mean, that's how you go poo, right? So you got to learn how to squat. A hinge, I think, is just a good balancing exercise. As I'm going to talk about later on, I don't believe in the whole quad dominance thing, but I do think there is a need for structural balance. So, you know, if we can build a hinge or start to, you know, just develop the hamstrings, to develop the glutes, to start to drive true hip extension, I think that's really valuable. a lunge or split squat. I mean, I created an entire product around single leg training and split stance training, but, you know, improved core, hip, pelvic, foot, knee stability. I mean, stability being the name of the game. There's a ton of value there. And addressing imbalances side to side, shutting off the trailing leg hip flexors. I mean, there's just a ton of value in incorporating some split stance work into your program. So some form or variation is going to be in pretty much every program I write. A push-up, and we're going to talk about this more later on, but teaching somebody to reach to open up the upper back, there's a ton of value there, whether it's keeping the shoulders healthy, whether it's shifting the center of gravity back, being able to open up that upper back area is of critical importance. A row or a chin is one, you know, I'd kind of put a question mark by because quite frankly, there's a lot of people starting off that I don't have do a row or chin exercise. And I know this is like blasphemy and I don't want to get ahead of myself because I'm going to talk about this more when we talk about structural balance. But, you know, if somebody is well-rounded and they move well and I'm happy with their kyphosis, their ability to expand and move air into their upper back, then by all means, they can do something like that. But if not, then I'm probably going to find something else. And then, of course, some form of core training exercise, I think, is just critical. I just don't believe in the fact that most of us can get away. Unless you're choosing all of the right progressions with your big bang compound lifts, everything's anterior loaded, you're naturally very balanced front to back. I just think everybody is going to need some form of accessory or direct core training in their program. So that would be R5. And then R6 would be an emphasis on output without, again, putting too much orthopedic stress on the body. So this, I think, is a great place for your gen pop people. Like, let's say in R5, you're really pushing the agenda of, hey, I want to get you to move better. I want you to feel the right muscles. Maybe we're not going to back squat super heavy, but we're going to do a goblet squat. We're going to teach you to squat the right way. You're going to feel your whole foot. Your pelvis is going to be underneath you. You're going to be able to push out of the bottom. That's all fine and dandy, but people want to feel like they worked out, especially your gen pop people. So how do you do that? This is really some of your money exercises, R6. It's the conditioning element. So nothing worse than an airtime bike. I mean, you can go 8 on, 52 off for 8 to 12 rounds and absolutely smash somebody at the end. And they feel like they got a good workout. So there's an option. Prowler. Again, it's concentric focused. You know, it's powerful. It's explosive. You feel athletic. When you're pushing a prowler, you have this vision that you're some boss level football player, you know. So a prowler is another great one. Ropes are another one where there's not a lot of risk there. You can go at it pretty hard, especially if it's a dude. He's wanting to, you know, feel the upper body muscles a little bit. I mean, you go like 10 on, 50 off, or even start to cut into that rest period a little bit. And ropes can be a really great conditioning workout, you know, with a little bit of supplemental upper body pump in there as well. So Saul, I appreciate your support, man, because I know you've donated to the show. So I appreciate that. And I hope this helps answer your question. But that's kind of my general thought process. And those are the main exercises that I would use to get somebody started on a Gen Pop program. All right, guys, our next question comes from Manpreet Singh. Manpreet would like to know, you know, he says, should we generally do a bit more posterior chain type movement or exercises, i.e. more pulling than anterior ones, i.e. pushing, because of our sedentary lifestyles? Should we have a 1-to-1 ratio in our pull push or 1.5-to-1, 2-to-1? And he's talking about upper body. So in a nutshell, Manpreet, the answer is maybe, or it depends, because that's the answer to all of these questions. Now, I know you talked about specifically uppers, but I'm going to talk about lowers as well, okay, just because I love you guys and hopefully this is valuable to you. So with lowers, this was absolutely our focus. You know, if I think back 10 years ago, I would have said you need to do at least like 2-to-1 posterior chain work to anterior chain work. And I think kind of my idea and my ideology has shifted here a little bit. So number one, let's have a moment here and talk real. squatting isn't bad. All right. Teaching somebody to squat isn't bad. We just talked about it in the last segment, but people need to learn how to squat. It's like a super fundamental exercise and movement pattern. You know, and obviously there's the real world functionality. If there's the zombie apocalypse and plumbing doesn't work, you got to be able to go to the bathroom. But I mean, as far as athletes go, the ability to triple flex, right? Ankles, knees, hips, the ability to change levels in sports. There's so much value there with regards to learning how to squat. And let's be honest, I don't think, you know, the term quad dominant really means what we think it means. I talked about this at the Physical Prep Summit years ago, but, you know, like the quads, it's not like we built them up and focused on, hey, I'm just going to get these huge quads. It's like the quads are overly relied upon because of a position that our pelvis is in, right? So if you're in this position of anterior pelvic tilt, big lordosis, your quads aren't necessarily dominant. They're just kind of forced to take on more of the load than they should. Okay. So let's stop blaming the quads. The real issue here is trying to get the pelvis back underneath us, right? Get the abs engaged, get the glutes and the hamstrings to do what we want. You know, so there's other questions that I would ask myself. You know, number one, can they hinge effectively? Right. So before I start bombing on these people with posterior chain work, can they even hinge the way that I want? Because let's be real, a lot of people can't. You know, and along those same lines, you know, can they extend their hip? I mean, how many people are walking around with minus 10, minus 15, minus 20 degrees of hip extension? Okay, so make sure they have the capacity to get into these positions first. And for me, when I think posterior chain, and this is something I think we've all been doing a lot more at IFAST lately, is kind of this idea of integrated knee flexion exercises, right? So something where the lower abs are engaged, the glutes are, you know, basically trying to control the pelvis, keeping the hip extended while we take the hamstrings through a knee extension pattern, right? So where we're resisting knee extension. So hopefully that makes sense. Too often we just think of the hamstrings as knee flexors, but can we control that knee extension and kind of moving into more hip extension with, say, a Valslide leg curl? A ball leg curl isn't maybe the best exercise, but it's the same general pattern, right? So these are the things that I'm more focused on with the lower body. Now, coming back to your question, Manpreet, when we're talking about the uppers, again, I think this is largely a myth. I discuss this a ton in my Physical Prep 101 product, talk about it again in my program design mentorship. But the question we have to ask ourselves first is, what position is this person's body in? And when we're talking uppers, some of the main areas I'm looking at are the thorax and the rib cage. Do they have a kyphosis? What position is the scapula in? Is it in a more neutral resting position, or is it really like retracted kind of all the time? And then last but not least, you know, what position is the shoulder itself in, right? And what kind of shoulder motion do they have access to? So I'll give you a really practical example. We get a lot of people in our gym when we evaluate them and their thorax is very extended. Okay, so imagine kind of the chest is pushed forward. You know, the upper back has lost that natural kyphosis. This is a big problem. Okay, because if you think about it, there's a natural curve to the scapula. Well, there should be a natural curve to the upper back and to the rib cage. And if there's not, then that scapula doesn't have a place to rest. And if it doesn't have a place to rest naturally, it's naturally going to be unstable. Okay. So here's what would happen if they don't have that normal kyphosis, right? And I start giving them a 2-to-1 ratio where they're rowing more than they're reaching. All I'm going to do is extend that thorax more, right? I'm going to close off that upper back even more. So I think the questions you have to ask yourself is, do they have a kyphosis? You know, if they don't, then we have to be doing something to drive air into that upper back, right? We have to probably, along with driving air into that upper back, get those shoulder blades to get out of that retracted position and get them to protract, get them to glide back around the rib cage, and then drive air into that upper back area. Okay. So on top of that, let's take it one more level. I would be doing a ton of reaching, All right. Now notice I didn't say bench pressing. I said reaching. So like push-up variations where you can really engage the serratus, make the arms long, open up that upper back. I think there's a ton of value there. So coming full circle to your question, I don't know if there's ever a case that I can think of where I would go 2-1 rowing to reaching. The ultimate goal would be to get somebody to 1-1 rowing to reaching. And that means, you know, they've got a pretty normal thorax position. They got a kyphosis. They've got all the necessary shoulder range of motion that I'd be looking for. But this is a big shift for me. And this is something that's changed a lot over the last 10 to probably at least the last 8 to 10 years, is moving away from this just row and, you know, focusing a lot more on reaching, opening the upper back, and restoring more normal thorax position and shoulder motion on top of that. Okay, our next question comes from Peter Malloy, and Peter wants to know, outside of accelerations themselves, what activities help teach or prepare the athlete to hit the appropriate body and limb angles that are necessary for acceleration? So really good question here. I'm going to assume, right, and you know what that does, but I'm going to assume we're talking about linear acceleration, but a lot of these principles or these ideas can be fleshed out to lateral acceleration as well. So whenever I'm thinking about sport-specific movements, I always think in the domain of general to specific, okay? And I think too often people live at one extreme or the other, right? So either you're totally general and your weight room strength is just there to get you as strong as possible and you hope that it's going to carry over. Or on the flip side, you've got your specific people that, you know, sometimes take specificity way too far and it's like all they're going to do is sprint. Okay, so I like to think a little bit more in the middle here. And when we're talking general techniques, squatting may not be a perfect example with regards to limb angles, but it's great from a general strengthening perspective. Right? It's going to strengthen the quads. It's going to strengthen the glutes, both of which are going to be really critical based on the positions you're in to accelerate. All right. So squatting is one. Number two, another one would be split squatting variations. Okay. Now the limbs are in a lot more specific positions, right? You've got some of that hip separation going on, all that good stuff. So I think there's a lot of value there as well. Now let's get out of the weight room. And let's start to focus more on contraction types, okay? Because, you know, the downside to the stuff that we do in the weight room is the contraction speeds tend to be slower, right? So now let's make it a little bit more specific, maybe with our body position and our contraction types. A big one for me is prowler sprints. And I come back to Joe DeFranco, who is a guy. I've only hung out with him a couple of times. Awesome guy. You know, I think he's way smarter than he wants you to believe. He's kind of got that Jersey kind of swagger to him. But I love Joe DeFranco. And, you know, I just remember him talking about how important pushing a heavy prowler was to his acceleration work and why some of his guys did so well at the NFL Combine or NFL Pro Days. So I think prowler sprints are huge. And you can do a lot of cool stuff there, right? You can really overload it early on and focus on like those first 2 to 3 steps. You can lighten it up. There's a lot of cool things you can do there. So prowler sprints are a big one. Sled sprints are another one that I really like. I don't like it as well for the first, say, 1 to 2 steps because generally there's a little slack in the sled. But if we're talking about like a 10 to 20 yard acceleration, I definitely like a sled sprint. Another one that I think most people maybe disregard or don't play around with enough, but like band resisted sprints or even something like a power skip. You know, so maybe with the power skip, you're not getting the same angles, But again, you're getting that explosive contraction type. You're working on like terminal hip extension, trying to be fast and strong and explosive. So I think band-resisted sprints and power skips are another tool. And then probably the last one, and one that I don't use a ton, I want to learn more about, and I want to be able to apply them a little bit better first, are some of the Bosch-based drills. And I do think there's value there for, again, creating hip separation, driving hip extension on the backside leg. So there's a bunch of different things in there, Peter, that you can play around with. I would say for me, I've had really good success with at least laying the foundation for general strength, or, and maybe a little bit later on, relative strength in the weight room with squats, split squats, and that sort of thing. But then if you want to make it more contextual, which we always do, prowler sprints, sled sprints, band resisted sprints, things of that nature will help you kind of smooth the transition into pure acceleration work. Because this is one of the big issues that I see. A lot of times, especially with young kids, they just don't understand the position they need to get into. So either they need context, or they simply don't have the relative strength to get into those positions and hold them. All right. So if you pull from those two different areas, the more general and the more specific, then you kind of sprinkle in elements of your own programming, you know, your own flair for however you want to set up a program. If you keep those elements in there, follow progressive overload, coach them up a little bit, then I think you're going to see really good success. Next up, we have Steve Hendry, and Steve wants to know, in my 40 for 40 special, you brought up two different points. Take care of yourself first, and balance is a myth. Do you have any personal indicators that tell you when you might not be prioritizing yourself and your own needs first? Now, I will say this, Steve, first of all, 40 for 40, I love that. I should have just used that, but chances are if ESPN would have found it, I'm sure they would have sued me or something. But the bottom line is, this is a great question and incredibly relevant. And the answer, to give you a blanket black and white answer, is absolutely yes. I do have indicators. Here are the big ones. Number one, the first thing I notice is that just my stress and my anxiety are up. Okay, so I start to lose my thought clarity. I just generally feel stressed out. I feel anxious. I feel like, you know, there's too much going on. I can't prioritize things, or everything is of equal value and importance. Okay, so that's number one. Stress and anxiety go up. I can feel it. Number two, my sleep quality gets really poor. And so what happens is I start to wake up a lot more, or I'll wake up super early, right? Like 4:30, 4:45, and I just can't go back to sleep. Like I can't shut my brain off. So in those cases, a lot of times what I'll get up and do is I will just get up and work, and I will just crank for like 2 hours, sort, organize, play catch up, just to try and like get my mind back in the right frame. Another one for me is just increased irritability and moodiness. And the worst part is, and you've probably been there with me, when we get moody, when we get irritable, it's not like the random person that gets the brunt of that. It's the people closest to you. So if, you know, I'm just moody with my wife, or I'm short with my kids and I don't have a lot of patience, that's when it's like, okay, you need to like pump the brakes here, champ. This is not on them. This is not a them thing. It's a you thing. All right. So with that being said, more than just showing like, oh, these are the indicators, there's absolutely indicators. I have them. You have them. We all have them. I think what's even more important is, let's talk solutions. All right. So for me, probably the keystone habit for me is working out. And it's pretty rare now that I'm not consistent. Like I'm not banging 405 squats anymore. I'm not training 2 hours a day anymore. But if for some reason I don't get to work out for, say, 5 days in a row, which hasn't happened in a long time, but if it does, that's when a lot of these things start to show up. So the first thing I need to do, I know I need to get a workout in. I mean, I got to get my breathing and my resets in, reposition my body, move some air. I need to just work out some of that tension, that aggression. I need to push some weight. I need to fatigue my body. And this may sound really kind of simplistic, but I think I was reading this book a while back, actually two or three different books. It was like, I read a book about sleep. Then I read a book about like skin health. And then I read another book about general health. And all three of them talked about if you're having issues later in life, you need to go back and figure out like what some of your routines were when you were younger. And I was just crazy active when I was a kid, like super, super active. Like there were times where I would play two sports in the same season. So I might have 4 or 5 hours of physical activity in a day. And now, even on a good day, maybe I get 60 to 90 minutes. So now just imagine those days where I don't get any exercise at all for 4 or 5 days. So I think this is really critical, is like, okay, finding ways to exercise frequently and intensely, whatever that means to you, is a huge, huge thing for me. So working out is number one. Number two is recalibrating my sleep. And that means going back to basics, going back to shutting the TV, iPad, whatever it is off 90 minutes before I go to bed. It's reading for an extended period of time. It's going through my resets, my stretching, taking a hot shower or bath, really just kind of enjoying the process of unwinding and relaxing. So it's setting the stage for that high quality sleep and then making sure I'm getting at minimum 7.5 hours. Another big one for me is, again, I just keep coming back to this idea of forced recovery. So people that are really wound up, that are high achievers, high anxiety, high stress, they need to find ways to shut themselves off. So for me, forced recovery is massage. You know, again, if I don't get a massage every so often, my body can tell, right? So it's in that rhythm. So for me, it's once a week or once every other week, depending on where I'm at. If I can't do one of those, then the float tank, thank goodness for my guys over at A Better You Wellness. I don't see them enough, but floating, you know, things of that nature that just force me to, you know, get rid of all the external noise, just chill out, relax, and lay there and shut off. I think those are huge. And then the last piece is unplugging. So this is something I notice a lot too. If stress and anxiety are high, I don't know if it's the cause or the symptom, you can help me out with that. But what I find is if stress and anxiety are high, a lot of times there's a lot of electronics involved, right? So I'm on my phone a lot, or I'm taking messages on Slack, or I'm checking my email like 30 times in a day. So a lot of times what I have to do there is like a hard reset on the electronics. It's like, okay, the laptop is shut off at 4 o'clock and it's not getting open till the next day. The phone is getting left downstairs. It's getting turned off. Notifications are off, or it's in airplane mode. Those are the things that I think are really going to make a powerful impact. So I absolutely have indicators, Steve. I would implore you, if you know them, great. If you don't, take some time to really like figure out, okay, what are my indicators? And then figure out strategies for you to help kind of get yourself back on the right track. For me, working out, sleeping, forced recovery, and unplugging. Those are like the main four that I always come back to. And if I do those four things, then chances are I'm going to get myself back on the right track. Okay, so our next question comes from Dylan Brown. And Dylan would like to know, what advice would you give to a young coach who's extremely passionate but introverted? I feel like it's hard to get respect when you're on the quiet side instead of really extroverted and loud. Okay, so Dylan, I don't think this is tough love, but I am going to answer your question with a question to start. And I'm going to ask you, is this really true? Okay, so is it really true that athletes will like, trust, respect loud coaches better than you? Or is this a perception that's based on your internal stories and your view of the world? Okay, Now, I'm not going to say that that's necessarily the case. Maybe the athletes you work with absolutely respond better to like this loudmouth, braggadocious type coach. I don't know. But I want you to answer that question first, because there's a lot of value in figuring out what your stories are and how they impact your life, your performance, your perception of the world. Okay? So you got to discern the difference between what's perception and what's reality. Now, let's talk about your question. I think number one, what you have to strive to do is to be authentic. Okay? So if you are not a loud, kind of in your face, motivational type coach, that's totally cool, bro. Like, I am not that guy either. There's a time when I can get somebody wound up and I got to clap a little bit. I got to give a little bit more juice. That's fine. All right. But I'm never going to be, you know, just like this really vibrant, outgoing, you know, just kind of yelling in your face kind of guy. That's not my personality. So you have to figure out ways to be authentic to who you are. Right? Don't try and change who you are. Play on your strengths. What makes you different? Okay. So chances are, if you're an introvert, maybe you're a little bit more thoughtful, and I'm generalizing here, but maybe you're a little bit more thoughtful. Maybe you are really focused on a deeper relationship, right? So here's what I would do. If I were you, find ways to take your strengths and then magnify them, right? So for you, you've got to find ways to connect that are comfortable for you. Because look, an athlete isn't necessarily just looking for motivation. Most athletes have, especially higher level ones, have enough intrinsic motivation. They don't necessarily need you, right? At least not every day. Maybe some days they need a little push. What they really want is to know that somebody is in their corner, that somebody cares for them, that somebody wants to see them succeed. Okay. So how can you find ways to connect? You know, the first thing I would do is show some form of physical but non-threatening way to introduce yourself or to interact with them. So the first thing I'm going to do with, again, I think I gave this analogy before, this example before, when my soccer girls come in, you know, they're teenage girls. So, you know, it's like, hey, what's up, Wampler? What's up, Cass? What's up, Gretch? And I'm going to give them a high five, right? So that's my physical but non-threatening way to kind of show them, hey, what's up? I'm excited to see you. For some of my basketball guys or my football guys, it's, hey, yo, what's up, Glenn? What's up, Keelan? It's, you know, dap, whatever. For some of my people I haven't seen in a while, it's a huge freaking bear hug because I miss them and I love them and I'm happy that they're there. All right. So that's like right off the bat, a way to build the connection. Then find ways in between sets, right? Like you can only be superficial for a little while, you know, hey, how you doing? Hey, what'd you do this weekend? That sort of thing. Like, hey man, tell me about your family. Like, what's your favorite memory of your brother, your sister, your mom, your dad? What's your favorite memory about sports? What do you want to achieve in basketball? Like, there's so many ways that you can connect. So I don't look at this as a negative at all, Dylan. Like, not at all. And maybe that's because I am, believe it or not, more introverted than I am extroverted. You just have to find ways to create connection points to build rapport, right? Because look, there's nothing wrong with this guy either. And I'm assuming it's another guy. Maybe it's just like a theoretical guy that we've created. But, you know, like everybody has to find their shtick, for lack of a better term. And, you know, again, the downside to this is sometimes it just takes time. Like if you're a young coach and you're just trying to figure out how to express yourself, like people probably sense that, you know, like you're a little uncomfortable, which makes them a little uncomfortable, which makes, you know, the building of the relationship just take a little bit longer. So it could just be an experience thing. Like now I've been doing this 18 years, so it doesn't matter. Boy, girl, man, woman, 18, 28, 38, 48, 78, you know, athlete, non-athlete, like I'm super comfortable in my own skin. I'm comfortable in my ability to coach. And so that makes the entire process that much easier. So Dylan, that's what I would do, man. I would just figure out, okay, I'm not trying to be something I'm not. So how can I be really real and authentic? You know, who am I? What makes me great? start to hang your hat on that, and then just figure out, hey man, how can I just find ways to genuinely and deeply connect with the athlete that's standing in front of me right now? And I guarantee, man, if you do this day in, day out for weeks, months, years on end, you will never have an issue with getting respect, with getting loyalty, with getting buy-in, because every athlete you work with is gonna know that you genuinely and truly care about them. Our next question comes from Jack Anderson. Jack wants to know, how do you implement, quote, corrective exercise, unquote, into your program effectively in a team setting? And should it be something you even bother to do if the athlete doesn't appreciate it or comply with it? So, Jack, this is a super loaded question, and it's something that I'm sure I could talk about for much longer than I will. But I want to start with a statement, and that is, the idea of corrective exercise is bunk, okay? There isn't like one magical exercise you're going to do that's going to fix your program or fix the way your clients and athletes move. It just doesn't work like that, all right? The whole program should be moving the needle in the right direction. So this is something I've just, you know, beat my soapbox drum about 1,000 times, but you know, the idea of corrective exercise is totally bunk. All you're trying to do is make your athletes move and feel better. All right. And if an exercise isn't doing that, then I would question if it's the right exercise. All right. So with that being said, I think there's absolutely a resounding yes in this answer. Okay. Yes, you should be doing this. But the ultimate issue or the ultimate hang up here is how you're selling it. Right. So when I hear that a coach is having issues with buy-in, right, or maybe the athletes aren't doing what are asked of them, you know, every now and then you just have a stinker, right? You just have a kid or an athlete that just doesn't really care. All right. So let's put that person off to the side, because I don't know if there's a lot you can do to fix them. But let's say you've got somebody that could be interested, that might be interested, but you just haven't found a connection point on yet. Okay, so here's the underlying issue. You got to be able to sell it. You have to be able to sell what you're doing. Okay, so for a given athlete, maybe they want to be faster on the court. Maybe they want to jump higher. Maybe they want to have a better first step. Okay, so these are all basketball examples, but take it to your sport. Like, what does the athlete standing in front of you want to get out of working with you? Okay, so if you know that, hey, this person wants to be more explosive, and you're trying to get them to do a hip flexor stretch because you've deemed that's important. Okay, well, how does a hip flexor stretch make them faster or more explosive? Right? You've got to help them connect the dots, because what makes perfect sense to us makes absolutely zero sense to them unless you explain it. Right? And this is something that I've tried to do a lot more as an educator, especially over the last 2 to 3 years, is like connect the dots. Because internally, I think we always know, or we assume, like, oh, if I know this, then my client or my athlete's going to understand it. Or if I just give them this cursory overview, then they're going to understand it. And it doesn't work like that. You have to really connect the dots and say A plus B equals C. Do you understand that? Okay. So there's another layer to this, right? So we have to sell them what they want. Right. And it gets a little bit trickier when you're in the team setting. Okay. Because you can't give them a blanket answer. Okay. Because in a team setting, if let's just say you want them all to hip flexor stretch. Well, one may be stretching his hip flexors because you want to give them a more powerful or explosive first step. Another may be stretching their hip flexors because they have lower back pain. Another may be doing it because they have hip extension. Okay, so that's fine, but you have to figure out what does each individual person want. You can't just give one blanket answer. Again, selling comes down to what does the person standing in front of you want or need. So hopefully that makes sense. It's not, it can't be a blanket generalized answer. You have to figure out what this one exercise is going to do for all of these different people and why it's important to them, and it's how it's going to help them achieve their specific goals. So fantastic question, Jack, and I hope this helps you out a little bit. But to kind of give you the summary bullet point here, it is, yes, you should absolutely be doing these sorts of things, but you got to figure out how you're going to sell it to each individual, even if they are working in a team setting, right? Because every single person out there has unique needs and goals. You just got to figure out how to sell it to them. And ultimately, if you can do that, then they will buy in and you will have more success as a coach. Our next question comes from Austin Parks, and Austin would like to know, how do you design a recovery session or low day? And this is a really good question, but it also is very general. So it forces me to ask a lot more questions. And so instead of just giving you a blanket, oh, these are the steps that I go through, I'm going to give you the questions that I would ask myself that would then allow me to design a recovery day. Okay, so here they are. Number one, where is this person at in the overall or annual programmer cycle? Okay, because a recovery session in preseason may look a lot different than it does in season, which may look a lot different than it is in the postseason or in the competitive period. Okay, so where are they at in the overall or annual programmer cycle? Number two, what are they recovering from? So recovering from a light practice is different than a hard session, which is going to be different from recovering from a game. Okay, so you got to ask yourself, what are they recovering from? Number three, what areas of the body are the most stressed or need the most attention? This is generally going to be a little bit more sport specific or based on the demands of, you know, the specific workout that they did, the training session. But if you can figure out what areas are most stressed, that's going to be really impactful in, you know, how you design or how you lay out that recovery program. And then last but not least, I think it's really important to think global and systemic versus local. All right. So do they just have like some really localized muscle damage, delayed onset muscle soreness, or are we talking about like on a much bigger level, do they have like this global or systemic fatigue that we're trying to get rid of or just kind of, you know, for lack of a better term, get them away from, get them into a more recovered or rested state? Okay. So Austin, it may not be the exact answer you were looking for, but I hope it helps because I think a lot of times if you can drill down a little bit deeper, if you can ask yourself these questions, then you can get a lot more specific into the exact needs of your athletes and then the stimuli that you're going to give them to create that recovery focused environment. So again, not totally sure if that answers your question, Austin, because nobody likes getting a question answered with more questions, but that's the process that I would go through to help figure out exactly what that athlete needs. Okay, our last question comes from Dan Minix. And Dan says, I've been asked to write an article for a popular blog in our field. I've been reading your stuff for years. This is my first venture and would like to continue it at some point as I enjoy writing. Any tips or guidelines? So this is probably something that I should do an entire podcast or article on, and not just in the vein of writing articles, but creating content in general. So if that's something you're interested in, by all means, let me know. It's something I can work on in the future. But I've got a couple steps, Dan, that I really think will help you. And the first one is without a doubt the most important. You need to get really clear on who you're writing to and what they want and need to hear. Okay, so I'll give you an example. If I'm writing an article for T Nation, right, that audience is vastly different than if I'm writing an article for Women's Health. Okay, so you got to get really clear, like, who am I writing to? What kind of language is acceptable? What are their specific goals, needs? What are the emotions that they're going through? Like, put yourself in their shoes for a minute. Okay. And then you got to figure out, okay, and then how am I going to communicate that effectively? Because if I can write an article for T Nation, I can probably be really brash and kind of outspoken, and I can use foul language, and it's totally okay. Versus if I'm writing something for Women's Health, the way I'm going to have to relay my message is probably going to be a lot different. Okay. For a lot of different reasons. So that's number one, get clear on who you're writing to. Number two, don't skip over this step, please. Go old school and outline it. I think so many issues when people are creating content could be foregone if they would just outline things first. Like, get really clear on, once you know who you're writing to, on what you're writing about. I mean, it's crazy. Like, so many of us have so many ideas bouncing around in our head, but there's no structure. There's no organization. That's why as coaches, I'm such a big proponent of, like, just outlining your progressions and regressions. Because if you do that, now there's organization, there's systemization to your thought. It's no different when you're trying to write an article, right? Probably not all of the points are equally as important. You probably want to lead with one of your most impactful things. Or there's a sequence that you need to follow, right, to build up and to make sure that your content is engaging and that it is, very, very clear and concise in the points that you're trying to make. Okay, so go old school, outline it. It will make your life so much easier. Number three, and I was going to properly attribute this quote to Hemingway, but evidently Hemingway never said it. But I think the quote is still somewhat valid. Write drunk, edit sober. Now, keep in mind, I'm not saying you need to go imbibe your favorite adult beverage before you write. But what I am going to tell you is when you start writing, you have to shut your internal editor off. So many people that I've consulted with on this in the past, either loosely or more directly, they really struggle. They get like 100 words in. They're writing their introductory paragraph and they're like already editing themselves and like trying to clarify points. It's like, no, you have to shut that off. All right. You have to just start getting things on paper. And I always joke around, but like, if you read any of the things that I wrote, if you saw a first draft, you would be like, this guy is a total idiot. No doubt about it. You would think I am a total and complete idiot, because there's times where I just trail off a sentence and it's just dot, dot, dot. There's times it's, finishing a sentence with just more here, all caps. There's times where I'm a freaking idiot. I need to retype all of this. I mean, it's really ugly, the first draft, but that's okay. Because I've talked about this so many times in so many different contexts, but it's always easier to edit than it is to create something from scratch. Okay, so write drunk, edit sober. Get something on the paper first, right? Get it all out, just brain dump, put it all out there, and then start to edit and revise and clean up how it looks and feels. Okay. Number four, edit multiple times and just be ruthless. If you write 2,000 words, chances are you can get it down to 1,500. Edit ruthlessly. If it doesn't move your point along, get rid of it. If it's an extra word that doesn't move the plot along, if it doesn't make things more clear and concise, get rid of it. Okay? So edit, edit, edit. And then one final piece of advice that I think is really helpful is to read out loud. So when you're writing something, I think the best writers, especially at least the ones on the internet, are the ones that write like you read or write like they speak. Okay? So once you've written it all, once you've edited it, actually read it out loud. And this is an old copywriting tip as well for people that write like sales copy for ads and that sort of thing. But if you read it out loud, then all of a sudden you figure out like what sentences really flow well, maybe what things aren't as clear or aren't as concise, or maybe where the words are just kind of like a little bit jumbled, for lack of a better term, or it's just doesn't flow the way that you would want, then you can go in and you can edit those as well. So my process, just to give you a little bit of an example, is very, very extremely rough draft. Just get it all out there, right? And then I'm going to start moving pieces around. I'm going to start the editing process. And then one of the big things that I do is I'll actually print it off, especially if it's something like going to T-Nation or bodybuilding.com, one of these bigger publications. I'm going to print it off and I'm going to actually edit it myself by hand, just because I tend to find errors that I don't see when I'm looking at a screen, right? Edit it that way, clean it up, read it out loud, edit it again. If you do all those things, chances are at the end of the day, it's going to be better than what like 95% of the people out there are putting out. Because so often now it's just so easy to create content and to just, you know, thoughtlessly put content out there. So if you do even a little bit of work on the front end, chances are the article that you spit out on the back end is going to be so superior to what other people are putting out there. It's going to absolutely blow people away. So Dan, sincerely hope this helps you out. By all means, when this article goes up, I would love to see it. So make sure you send me a link. All right, last but not least, we have our lightning round. So a little bit different because I don't have a guest, it's just me. But I got four or five questions here from people that, you know, pretty short questions, and I'm gonna give fairly short answers too. So without any further ado, let's go. So the first one comes from Debbie Kaplan. Debbie says, please come to San Francisco or Oakland. So Debbie, first off, thanks for the love, I appreciate it. As of now, there's no plans to head out to the Bay Area. Always open and willing, though, if somebody wants to host me for a seminar or they need some consulting or something like that, I'd be happy to go out there. But I will say, spend about 4 or 5 days out in the Napa Valley, Sonoma area for a good friend's wedding this past May. Absolutely loved it. My ginger hair and my pale skin absolutely loved the moderate temperatures and lack of humidity, though. So I would not be opposed to coming back. Number two, Rob Van Valkenburg would like to know, how did you grow your business from the initial idea to where it is today? So Rob, I appreciate the question. Unfortunately, this goes so far beyond what I could do even in a normal segment. So I think in the future, I'm going to do like an ode to iFast type podcast where I talk about, you know, from the starting point where Bill and I were in life, what made us, you know, start to come up with and flesh out the concept for iFast, as well as what I think would be most instructive, the evolution of iFast over the past 10 years. So if you're listening to this and you would be interested in that type of episode where kind of talk about the evolution of iFast, start to finish, business side, training side, the ups and downs, let me know. I would be happy to do that in the future. Number three, how do you find out what you're worth, from Lucas Sokol? So Lucas, again, this is kind of a loaded question, but I would say the best way to start is to figure out what are you worth for in an hour, right? And I don't know you. I don't know anything about where you're training. But I would just say, you know, kind of put it out there. Like, you probably have some ideas to what you're worth. The best thing you can do is, hey, start trying to charge that for an hour, or multiply it times 8 and figure out if that's what you're worth for a day. So there's a lot of influences there, right? Because if I'm in Muncie, Indiana, which is where I grew up, and it's a very kind of lower middle class city, what I could charge there is vastly different from what I can charge in Indianapolis. And what I could charge in Indianapolis is probably a lot different than what I could charge if I moved to New York or LA or Miami. Okay, so that would be my best advice. You probably have a ballpark idea. Put it out there, man. Start trying to charge that for a one-on-one, or charge that for a consulting hour, or times it by eight and charge it for a consulting day and see who will bite. And the market will kind of tell you if you're like flooded with offers and people that want to spend that money on you, then chances are you undervalued yourself. And if it's crickets and nobody wants to train with you or nobody's going to pay you for consulting, then chances are your price is probably a little bit too high. Number four, Sachin McDonald, hopefully I pronounced your name correctly, would like to know, what's the best way to help athletes with achy knees who are most likely overtrained? Whoa, losing it here. Who are most likely overtrained from practices and games? So number one, shameless plug, have them pick up a copy of Bulletproof Knees. That would probably help. You know, the downside to this is, I'm assuming you're talking in season, Sachin. There's not a ton you can do. I'd be focusing a lot on the recovery side of things. So as far as exercises go, again, I love squatting, but in this case, they're probably already overloaded. It's probably only going to make things crankier. Focus on posterior chain dominant exercises. Try and get the calves and the hip flexors, lower back, try and get those to shut off a little bit. Maybe it's static stretching. Maybe it's massage. Maybe it's foam rolling. Work on some targeted resets and breathing exercises, trying to drive some air into the back side of the body, right? So they're not shifted forward all the time. So they're not taking all that stress either on the anterior knee joint surfaces or like on the patellar tendons. So I would start there. Those are local things, obviously systemic things as well, massage, float tanks, things that will just not only help locally, but also just help kind of the CNS shift from that sympathetic, toned up, inflammatory type state to a little bit more parasympathetic state would probably help. Then last, but most definitely not least, my man, Joe Ken, wanted to know on the Twitter, am I a boss? And I will tell you this, I am a boss, but I am not the boss of bosses, because that is reserved for my guy, Joe Ken. So guys, that does it for this week's episode. This was super fun. Hopefully you don't mind me doing two MR radio shows in a row, just kind of how it worked with my schedule, with the coaches and the interviews that I have set up. But you guys know I love and appreciate you. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll be back soon with our next episode. Take care.